This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again. I'm Dr. Woodard, your host, and I will introduce my guests shortly. Our topic today is going to be influenza, however, so if you've got some questions or worries or concerns you want addressed, stick by and we'll give you some ways to contact us if we don't address your particular concerns. Beforehand, I want to remind you I've been doing a little bit about logical fallacies at the beginning of each of these programs. The idea here is to have people also beginning to think a little bit more clearly, more logically, and when you're trying to convince something or somebody about something or to argue, you are going to use some logic and you're going to use some evidence. And those two things are really what makes the difference. Sometimes we don't use such clear logic, and those things might be called logical fallacies. I've used a number of them, and today I'm going to use an example of a kind of a subtype of the one that says, well, look, if A preceded B, then A must therefore cause B. And that is not necessarily true. And a subtype of that argument or logical fallacy is confusing what's called correlation with causation. And I'm going to take a precise example of this from Carl Sagan, the late Carl Sagan's website. And he uses this example. It says, for example, during the 1990s, both religious attendance and illegal drug use were on the rise. It would be a fallacy to conclude, therefore, that religious attendance causes illegal drug use. So just because one precedes the other does not make it true. It's also possible, another explanation might be that drug use leads to an increase in religious attendance. So that B, the later one, could have caused A, or it could be possible that both drug use and religious attendance are increased by a third variable. So a third variable may cause A and B. Such an example would be that an increase in societal unrest leads to both increased drug use and religious use. And it's also possible in a sequence of happenings that both variables are independent of each other and appearing to be causing correlation is just a coincidence. So kind of keep it in mind that just because two things are closely related in time, like wearing shoes as a kid is not the reason our feet get bigger as we grow older. My guests today are Dr. Jay Butler. He's the Chief Medical Officer. He oversees the Division of Public Health and Emergency Preparedness for the Division of Public Health in the state of Alaska. He's been an epidemiologist for the CDC for a number of years and for a brief period of time was also the state epidemiologist. And also with us is Laurel Wood. She is the Immunization Program Manager for the Alaska Division of Public Health. And both of them have been on before, so welcome back.
Oh, thank you. It's good
thank
to be back.
Thank you very much.
So usually every year or so we come in and talk about influenza. Let's remind everybody why that might be an important thing to do.
Well, Dr. Woodard, influenza continues to be a major public health concern. It's a major cause of death. It continues to be one of the top 10 leading causes of death in the United States and in Alaska every year. The occurrence of influenza, which is generally in the winter months here in the northern hemisphere, is associated with a twofold increase in the rates of death caused by pneumonia and influenza grouped together. And we see this sort of wave that occurs every year. The most people who are most likely to die, of course, are the elderly, the very young, people with underlying health problems such as heart disease or chronic lung conditions. We also talk about influenza because it's a preventable disease. We have vaccines that can prevent it. We actually have antiviral drugs that none of these are perfect, but they can help reduce the rates of illness caused by influenza infection.
Okay. Another, I think, thing that's important when I'm talking to patients is there's often a misunderstanding about what we mean by influenza. So, Laurel, you want to try to help us understand what we mean specifically about influenza? And I'm going to ask you, clear me up on what flu is, too.
Well,
to me, I try to make a distinction. Maybe that's not appropriate, but that's part of what I'm getting at.
Well, influenza is actually the virus that causes the illness. The vernacular for it, though, I think that most people call it the flu. I would be interested in hearing, you know, how you make a differentiation between the two.
Yeah, I'm worried about the use of the word flu because so many people use the word flu to mean vomiting and diarrhea illness,
right,
or other viral illnesses. And that leads to the confusion in my mind that people think they get the flu from the vaccine or, hey, this doesn't work, Dr. Woodard.
Exactly. You're exactly right. Actually, when I hear it the most often is when people call it the stomach flu,
right,
which, you know, influenza is a respiratory illness. It doesn't have, in most people, any kind of gastrointestinal kinds of symptoms associated with it. It's respiratory. It's coughing. It's fever, it is muscle aches and being extremely tired, and there's usually a really rapid onset of all this. Whereas there are a lot of other respiratory illnesses that are going around every year that people tend to call the flu. So now I understand what you meant by that.
Right. So, and how else is it different from the common cold, which is the vast majority of things that people would assume is the flu?
Right. Well, a cold is usually doesn't have quite as rapid an onset, and you're much more likely to have runny nose, a cough, a hacky kind of cough. Also, I used to work for someone in public health in another state who said there's no question about the difference between a cold and the flu, influenza rather.
Right.
When you have a cold, you can keep going. When you have influenza, you can be the most dedicated worker in the world and you feel too sick to keep going to work.
Okay. It's a more significant illness. I guess that's the most important thing I think about trying to get across to people. Usually lasts longer, certainly hits those with disabilities much more difficult. And as you've pointed out, Dr. Butler, this is preventable, whereas we're not at a point with a common cold that we can do much about prevention.
Right. And the complications are more serious also. I mean, there is that hit by the truck feeling that distinguishes oftentimes influenza from the common cold. But among adults, pneumonia is the most serious life-threatening complication. And among children, we're really getting a much better handle now on how common influenza is in children. Middle ear infections are a common complication also.
Right. Yeah, as a pediatrician, although you don't see this written about, it seems to me like there's certain viral infections that really do predispose to purulent or bacterial complications. And I think that's kind of what you're saying is that true otitis media, true bacterial pneumonia, true sinusitis seem to be a little bit more common after certain viruses, and influenza is one that would come to my mind anyway.
Yes.
You talked about prevention. How do we go about preventing this?
Well, probably the most effective tool for prevention of influenza is the vaccine. And the recommendations for vaccination have broadened in recent years. Historically, we focused primarily on vaccinating people age 65 and older, as well as people with underlying illnesses. But those age categories have changed to where now we were doing universal vaccination at age 50. We're now also vaccinating children, and there have been two major drivers behind that. One is the realization that influenza can be a very serious infection in young children. We just weren't testing them before. And we now know that several hundred children die in the United States each year of influenza infection. We also know the highest rates of infection are in school-age children. They're much less likely to become severely ill, but they have higher attack rates. They miss school. They also are an important reservoir then to spread the virus to other more susceptible people.
I thought you were going to say also that they're the ones that are spreading it to those older and maybe more at risk individuals who are harder to immunize.
Yeah, as the mosquito is to malaria, so the child is to influenza,
right,
yes.
Right. So we have access as pediatricians and people who take care of kids a little bit more to those individuals, and it's a little bit more likely we can immunize them. And if we get that immunization, then we get to a principle of immunization treatment, which is kind of like a herd immunity deal. The more we get immunized, the more we can control a larger group of people or protect a larger group of people. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
And that's part of the thought process.
One other thing about that is that those children often may be the ones who have siblings who are below 6 months of age who can't be immunized, the infants. There isn't a vaccine available for them. And those infants are also the ones who may have the most severe complications, along with elderly people. Young infants can also. So vaccinating the children in that family will also be a good way to protect the infant who can't be vaccinated.
Maybe this is a good time to remind our listeners, this is Line 1, and we're talking about influenza with two experts today. If you have questions, comments, please get in touch with us. Let me tell you how you can do that. Locally, 550-8433 is a number you can call us during the next 45 to 50 minutes, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And a number of you have realized you can now email us as well at line1, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. And we'll try to answer those questions during the next hour or so. After 3 o'clock, we won't be here, and although you may hear the program again between 7 and 8 on KSKA, that's a taped rebroadcast. What's going on in the influenza environment so far in this country this year?
Well, so far we've not had any isolates of the influenza virus in Alaska. The way we do surveillance and be able to assess what's happening with the infection in this country involves not only isolation of the virus, but also surveillance for influenza-like illness, which includes, of course, a lot of things that cause the type of respiratory crud that Laurel was referring to. But the number of visits to physicians during the influenza season tends to increase dramatically at the same time we begin to get the isolates. So it's a pretty good way to tell what's going on. So far, actually, our rates of visitation for influenza-like illness, also death rates due to pneumonia and influenza, really haven't gone up. In fact, they're a little bit below the historical averages. It's way too early to say this will be a mild year, though, and I think that's an important point to make. The peak of influenza season on average is in February, but as you may remember a few years ago, we had a peak in December. We're clearly not having that this year. Sometimes it's much later. So as we say, when you've seen one influenza season, you've seen one influenza season, and it's still early on. And it's also, I have to say, it's not too late to influenza vaccine.
Yeah, it's one of the benefits, I guess, is we're getting maybe to this program a little late. The timing of it is always an important issue. It turns out to be a good timing if we're not in the middle of an outbreak, because it allows people who do hear about this and are convinced that it's a smart thing to do and go get immunized. And I'm one of those. I've done that. So this year is not terribly atypical. There's plenty of time to go get the immunization. Is the immunization status, the vaccine, available in plentiful supply this year? That's another issue that always seems to be worth talking about.
We're doing really well this year. There should be over 140 million doses of vaccine available in the country. But we still have lots of vaccine available in multiple locations around the state, including our public health centers and at local pharmacies and obviously at physicians' offices. So it is readily available. It's great that we don't have a shortage. And the point that you were making bears repeating, it is absolutely not too late to be immunized. A lot of times I think we have it in our heads that if it's after Thanksgiving, it's too late to get a flu shot. And that certainly isn't the case, and I would highly recommend it. The vaccine takes about 2 weeks to be effective. So, and since we aren't in the middle of any kind of an outbreak situation right now, it's certainly a great time to be immunized.
We have a listener on the line who's got a question that seems somewhat apropos to what we're talking about right now. Karen, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed by a physician as having had the flu this year, and yet I have not had the flu shot, one the apple before the cart came on that one. And so my question is it too late to take the flu shot, and would that be beneficial, or should I just wait until next year?
I'm gonna ask a question just to be, heretical or whatever. I want to know how you were diagnosed.
I saw a physician, and I explained my symptoms, and he observed them, and from that doctor's visit, he surmised I was probably his third patient that had come in with the flu.
Kadok. All right. Let's keep in – I'm going to just – I'll be the clinician here, not the public health guy. It's sometimes difficult to be sure, and when physicians are making decisions, we like to know what's in the community. So the epidemiology, knowing what's in the community is helpful and is we've heard already, we're not really too clear that we're having much of an outbreak, so it's possible that the diagnosis is incorrect despite the physician's best efforts. I just want to make that comment before I turn this over to Dr. Butler.
Yeah, Karen, and I would add that the diagnosis of the flu, and we're on radio, so you can't see that I'm using my fingers to make quotation marks, is in many ways a clinical diagnosis in your case. And in the public health and clinical worlds, we might prefer to use the term influenza-like illness, meaning that it looks like flu, it smells like flu, but it's not confirmed to be flu. So in terms of what you probably did for this illness, which was probably, I'm going to guess, symptomatic treatment, not any kind of specific antibiotic or antiviral medication, is appropriate. That said, since we don't know if it's influenza and we are not seeing a lot of influenza activity, certainly don't have any viral isolates yet, I think the chances of it being actual influenza virus infection are probably pretty low. And so getting a flu shot would be a very reasonable thing to do at this point.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Karen. All right. Let me take Karen's question a little bit further. She went to a physician. She got a rapid test for influenza, came back positive for influenza type A. We don't know what type of influenza. We haven't talked about the complications of the diagnosis in the vaccine. But what would you tell her then? Does she still need a vaccine if she had a confirmed case?
Well, and that's the key to that question was, is that a confirmed case?
All right.
And I'm sure – I think this is a leading question. You want me to talk about predictive value of diagnostic tests, maybe?
Not entirely, but I'm also saying there's more than one type of protection in the influenza vaccine as well.
Absolutely. And before we leave this topic of the accuracy of the diagnostic test, the rapid test is a very good test for what it does, but it is going to be more accurate once we actually have influenza in the community. It's one of the reasons why we use the highly specific tests such as viral isolation to really say, hey, influenza is here. Now, that said, depending on what type of rapid test is done, some of the tests that are available are only good for influenza A, and we sometimes have both influenza A and influenza B circulating in the community. And yes, you can get influenza more than once during a season. You can have influenza A and influenza B. The vaccine actually is good against three different types of influenza virus. Two types of influenza A, which is really a shapeshifter. It's a virus that comes in literally dozens of types. And it also has a component for influenza B. So even if Karen actually did have influenza A infection, she still would be at risk for influenza B, and a vaccination would provide protection against that.
So for many people, even with well-documented influenza infections, it's not unreasonable to still get immunized.
Absolutely.
Is that fair to say?
Oh, I totally agree.
You know, we got kind of deep there for a second. We were talking about these rapid tests, and then we talked about, you know, culture. So a rapid test is what I heard you say is a very quick thing a doctor can do in their office. It's a good screen, but it's not always that specific. And so a culture would be better, but more time consuming.
Exactly. It takes time. It has to be shipped to the state virology lab in Fairbanks, which I'll add we have a beautiful new virology lab there on the university campus. That also provides not only a more specific diagnostic test, but it also provides a public health service in that we know much more about what are the specific types of influenza that are circulating in Alaska and whether or not we have a good match between the types of virus that are circulating and what's in the vaccine.
Okay. So I guess the point I'm trying to get out to our listeners is, you know, medicine is still somewhat of an art. It's getting better and better scientifically, and we know more and more about the goods and bads about our tests, but it's a clinical judgment to a large degree. The other issue that came up is you talked about A and B, and you've implied this is a moving virus, and I kind of want to ask you to talk about how this particular virus has evolved to try to fool our own immune system every year.
Yeah. Well, maybe a primer on influenza virus would be a good next step. There are actually three types of influenza virus, A, B, and C. We don't worry too much about C in human medicine because it doesn't really infect humans very often. It's more of a veterinary pathogen. Influenza A is the one we worry about the most. It exists in nature, infecting waterfowl, and sometimes changes to infect a number of other species of mammals, including human beings. And generally what we see are influenza A based on molecular typing that are in two broad families we call H1N1 and H3N2. But even within those type of typings, they can shift season to season. And that's why we generally have a vaccine that changes every 2 to 3 years, because the types of viruses that are out there are circulating change. B is also one that causes infection in humans, maybe a little milder than type A. The biggest problem with influenza A is this is the type of influenza that causes pandemics. And pandemics occur whenever a new strain emerges that basically fulfills three criteria. One is that it's a virus to which human beings have little or no immunity. Two, it has to be able to infect humans and cause illness. And three, it has to be able to make that change to be able to spread easily from person to person. There's been a lot of concern about the H5N1 avian influenza in Asia, and that's a virus that has continued to be primarily a pathogen in birds that occasionally transmits to humans, and at least in a couple of instances may be transmitted from one person to one other, but it hasn't done this person-to-person-to-person spread, which is what we would see for a pandemic.
All right. So I want to come back to Laurel, because one of the questions I've got, and I think maybe our listeners have, is if this virus is changing so fast, how do we make a vaccine so quickly, and what problems does that cause? But let me stay on the bird flu, which is the avian flu question you've had. And so what I've heard you say is that if this influenza virus, which is constantly undergoing pressure from the environment, decides to change in a way from an avian-only species to a human species, that could cause a pandemic. But if it's not transmissible person to person, that would stop it. It doesn't meet the three criteria. It's got to infect humans. It's got to be transmissible. And what was the third one?
It has to be transmitted person to person.
So far with what we've been seeing, there's very rare person to person transmission of these viruses that seem to have their origin in the avian species.
Yes. Now, that said, most pandemics probably come out of the avian species, perhaps going through swine. We've heard about 30 years ago a lot of talk about swine influenza. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that swine influenza still occurs also, that pigs become infected with influenza, occasionally transmit it to humans. But again, it doesn't then evolve into a person-to-person-to-person transmission. When that occurs, then there's a pandemic. We certainly know that happened three times during the 20th century. Certainly could happen again.
Laura, when I get immunized or get the natural disease, either one, measles, I've got a lifelong immunity for all intensive purposes. So I don't have to worry about getting re-immunized. That seems to not be the case with influenza. What kind of problems does that cause?
Well, as Dr. Butler has already said, the influenza virus changes. It mutates from one year to the next. So the way we determine what's going to be in the vaccine is through the World Health Organization. They have locations all around the world where they are studying and doing surveillance to determine what type of influenza is being found, and then make their best educated guess about what types will be circulating in the northern hemisphere, for example, in the following flu season. For us, it'd be in the winter. So around February, the leaders of the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and others determine which three types of influenza, which three strains should be in the vaccine for the coming year. As Dr. Butler has already said, it has two type A viruses and one type B. And so in most years, we end up with, again, it is an educated guess, and you can end up with a really good match, and it is exactly what we had anticipated being seen, and the vaccine can be very effective. In other years, the match between those three strains and what's actually circulating may not be quite as good, and therefore the vaccine may not be quite as effective, but there can be some crossover from the vaccine types that were selected with the types that are appearing, and you can still have some partial protection.
Mm-hmm. And two immediate thoughts come up with this is effective as this vaccine seems to be, it might not work if the guess is wrong or if what is expected to happen doesn't happen. Then we have a vaccine that may be very effective for protecting against the viruses, but that it's generated to do, but a new vaccine comes or a new strain, a change in the influenza vaccine makes it more not susceptible to the vaccine, not preventable by the vaccine. So does that happen very often? I mean, is that something that is a real worry, or so far we've been pretty good at what we're doing?
I think for the most part we do really well, but occasionally something will happen. Again, the decision has to be made in February for vaccines that we're not giving until the following fall. So sometimes we can have a really dramatic change, for example, in the type of virus that begins to circulate. But more often than not, the vaccine is quite effective. Of course, the other factor in how effective the vaccine will be is the host, the person who's receiving the shot. It's an unfortunate thing to say that the vaccine doesn't work as well in people who are older, and yet they're the ones who are the most at risk for complications. So that's yet another reason for us to be vaccinating all the people that surround people who are at high risk. In particular, it's important for healthcare workers to be immunized because they can be maybe the problem with influenza for them won't be as bad, but it can be terrible if they infect people around them.
I guess it's reasonable to say, I've often tell patients that these organisms have been around for millions of years. They're pretty good at fooling us. And it's generally fair to say that most of these viruses, including influenza, are most contagious perhaps even before we know we're sick. Jay, you're an infectious disease. Is that true of influenza particularly?
Well, certainly it's clear that people can shed virus in the 24 hours before they have onset of symptoms. No. And it seems most likely that transmission can occur for a period of at least a few hours before people even know they're sick. The greatest period of shedding is during illness, but that is a major challenge for non-vaccine-type methods of controlling transmission and trying to isolate yourself. I mean, if you don't feel ill, you're not going to know if you're infected and shedding the virus.
Mm-hmm. I'm hesitant to start bringing this up, but I think it's important to talk about and use semantics while in science and be very specific. And those of you who listen carefully, I think, to what Jay just said, it's one thing to be shedding a virus and another thing to be contagious. And there's a jump to that conclusion. Just because you find a virus on a table, if you're looking for it, doesn't mean that that is an infectious agent. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. The laboratory testing may be much more sensitive at recovering the virus than actually what it takes to infect another human being. In other words, you may be able to detect as few as 10 viruses a swab at the table, but it may actually take many more than that to make you ill.
Okay, so our disinfectant advertisements need to keep that in mind. Anyway, okay, so let me remind our listeners, you can get to us with questions at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Toll free, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at lineone, lineone, all one word, at kska.org. We do have an email from a listener named Judy who wants to know if flu is not the proper if these words are not correct, what is the proper descriptor? And I think she was talking about, I don't see all of it on my email, about vomiting and diarrheal illness. And I guess I'll try to just explain that many viruses, which are sometimes used the term flu,
may cause vomiting and diarrhea. There are a number of viruses that may also cause vomiting and diarrheal illnesses. We often use the term gastroenteritis to mean that term, and there are a number of viruses that do that, Judy. I make a plea to my patients and try not to get my staff to use the word flu because of all this misconception, which leads to things like, oh, I got the flu from the vaccine, or I got the flu anyway, which the evidence suggests neither one of those are very common.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, there's a lot of other viruses that circulate during the wintertime that cause respiratory tract infections.
Sure.
So that can look very much like real influenza virus infection and not be.
Yeah. Again, making the case is it's easier and to be pretty sure about influenza based on symptoms, but it's, again, easier if we have a rapid test and we know influenza is in the community. You have to be a little suspicious when it may look like influenza, but nobody else is being reported. It's not documented cases are not being reported, or it's not the right season. Doesn't mean it may not happen. Again, I guess it's the coincidence causality argument we used earlier. Okay. Who should be immunized?
Basically, everyone. We're working our way into that. We are almost at universal recommendations now. But our emphasis is on children, as we've already discussed, from 6 months through 18 years of age. People who have chronic health conditions that can put them at risk for complications from influenza, and this would be people with chronic pulmonary or cardiovascular disease, those sorts of things that could make them much more susceptible to the problems that can result from flu. People over the age of 50, and then, as I've already mentioned, all the people who surround those people at high risk. So that could be healthcare workers, daycare facility operators, teachers. Within the next few years, I'm really confident we will have an all-out recommendation that everyone should receive an influenza vaccination every year.
I was listening to reading an email at the same time you're telling me, but I'm skeptical of the everyone. What about egg allergic? Now, did you address these potential exceptions? There's always an exception.
Thank you for the correction, because certainly with influenza vaccine or any other vaccine, there are some people who have medical contraindications, meaning they shouldn't get a particular vaccine. And in the case of influenza vaccine, it is made in an egg-based protein, and so people who have severe allergic reactions to eggs shouldn't be getting this vaccine. There are a couple of other things that people need to look at also if they've had a severe reaction to a prior dose of the vaccine. But for the most part, the main the main contraindication we would look at for influenza would be a severe allergy to eggs.
Another listener has written in, and we've kind of talked about this already, but I want to go ahead and address her question. She said, why do some segments of the medical centers not require all of their employees to get a flu shot? For example, receptionists and nurses. She knows that Virginia Mason required all of their staff to get a flu shot or else wear a mask, and the incidence of flu dropped dramatically. Good for Virginia Mason, but why doesn't everybody do that?
Well, there are multiple levels to that question, and some of them are legal. Neither Laurel or I have doctorates in jurisprudence, so I'll maybe defer to another caller to help answer the legal side of that. From the public health side of that, really affirm what the caller or writer in this case pointed out, is that vaccination of healthcare workers has been associated with decreased rates of influenza among patients in healthcare settings, particularly long-term care facilities. Some facilities have moved to a more mandatory type of policy for influenza vaccination. Some other facilities have actually just really pushed the vaccine and been able to increase their coverage. I know Alaska Native Medical Center increased their rates from really kind of on par with the national averages in the 40-some percent range to up over 60%. And that was done actually even without the mandates, just really encouraging employees to be able to protect the patients through getting immunization. So it's one of those areas where there's a lot of drivers, and we're healthcare providers, and we don't always set the best example. But I think when healthcare providers are confronted with the fact that their patients' safety is at stake, they're much more likely to get vaccinated.
Yeah, I don't think the healthcare arena is much different than the other parts of the economy. I mean, it's still an educational thing, and it is, I think, illegal to require. I may be wrong, but every year I try to get all of my employees to get an immunization, but I can't make them do it. It's to my knowledge, and so there is that problem. And then there are people in the healthcare system that still may have worries about that are inappropriate. So let's talk some more about that. Let's particularly the most common one is, oh, I got influenza or I got the flu. Please, hopefully, if you're listening, you understand the difference between those two things. When I got the vaccine, why is that pretty doggone unlikely?
It is the most common misconception about the vaccine, and it is pretty doggone unlikely, as you said, because the vaccine contains killed virus, meaning it literally cannot cause the flu. The injection that we give cannot cause the flu because it's a killed virus. It can't grow. It just can't cause the disease. A lot of times, though, people say, including my own husband, has said to me, well, I was fine until I got that flu shot, and then a day later I felt terrible, and it was the vaccine, and it took me years to convince him to try again, and now he's a big believer in getting the influenza vaccine each year. But what happens is people, as I mentioned earlier, it takes about 2 weeks for the vaccine to be effective, so sometimes people do get an influenza shot and then may get influenza within the couple of weeks after getting the shot. So they were already perhaps incubating it before they had mounted a protective defense as a result of the vaccine. And then, again, as we've already mentioned, anything respiratory in the winter tends to be called the flu, and people assume that if they get a cold or sniffles or anything after the vaccine, that it was because they got influenza after getting that shot. But it is a really common misconception, and as you have pointed out, it is one that is held sometimes by healthcare providers too. It's mm-hmm. one of the major educational hurdles that we try to overcome each year.
Yeah, I think even that misperception goes as far as some people believe in there's a brief period of increased vulnerability right after receiving the vaccine, but there's really no scientific basis for that with the influenza vaccine. I will add, we do have two vaccines now, and as Laurel was saying, it's very unlikely to develop influenza from the flu shot. In fact, it's biologically impossible. The flu mist or the influenza vaccine that's delivered as a spray is a live virus. It also will not cause full-blown influenza, but some people will develop a mild runny nose, a little bit of a scratchy right. throat with that because it is a live virus, but it's one that's attenuated, as we say, and it's been altered so that it doesn't cause full-blown influenza.
Actually, we just had a caller a listener who wrote about that, and she said, what about the live nasal vaccine? Can I get the influenza from that? What is the real incidence of documented cases of influenza after the live virus vaccine? I mean, we're talking really low numbers. I mean, we can't, you know, a good scientist is never going to say never, but it's not likely.
It's very unlikely. The way that the nasal spray is developed, it's what's called cold adapted, which means it's really only effective in the nasal passages. And once you get down into the lungs and areas where you would expect influenza would develop, the body is too warm there, so it really can't work that way. And as far as effectiveness, the nasal spray vaccine, actually studies have shown repeatedly that it's much more effective in younger children. So not only do they like it better because it's not a shot per se, it actually has been shown to be more effective for them.
What about the egg allergy issue in the nasal spray?
It is the same as in the injectable vaccine. Both vaccines are developed in egg-based proteins.
Okay. There's another issue that drives me a little crazy. I still see a significant number of patients with asthma. and it's contraindicated by the company because they have not documented that it's safe and effective in children with asthma, and there has been some evidence that perhaps there's a little bit more likelihood to have an asthma exacerbation after the influenza vaccine. I have my own opinions. I won't share those at this thing because I frankly think that asthma is much more dangerous than influenza. What are your comments on using that live virus vaccine in a child that might already have asthma as a diagnosis?
Well, as you pointed out, the manufacturer has clearly said that a physician or any healthcare provider should assess the child to see if they've had any incidents of asthma or wheezing within the last 12 months. And if the answer to that is yes, they say you shouldn't get the vaccine. I think this is just another indication of how we try to be really super careful with all vaccines. And if you don't have the proof that something is safe, then you don't want to go ahead and recommend it. So I don't believe that they actually had any huge instances of problems. I think it was being more in the safe than sorry category.
I've commented on the safe than sorry thing in the past, too, and it kind of bothers me. I'll just say it again. Sometimes when you're being safe, you end up causing more problems, and it's a downside to the some of our approaches about treatments and you know, scaring the public and so forth. When it really, there's a theoretical risk more than there's an actual risk. And so by withholding some things, we may be causing more problems. It's more of an ethical issue than a science issue to a large degree.
I think in this issue, though, because we do have an alternative, mm-hmm. we do have the injection, that it's not like you're making a decision between not protecting a child at all. You have an alternative way to protect them.
From a pediatric standpoint, it's certainly much easier to sell this vaccine when parents don't like all the shots, and I can't blame them about the pain and discomfort. This is not a shot. It's a nasal spray. We're telling them it's a little bit more effective of a vaccine as well. Pretty easy to make that sell, although we still have families who still don't think they need the influenza vaccine despite our efforts. So, what else do we need to say about potential complications of vaccines or misconceptions about the vaccines, and even maybe opening up more than just influenza? Is there something from a public health standpoint you all want to get across about vaccine safety and effectiveness?
Well, on influenza specifically, I think there has been discussion certainly about the fact that the multi-dose vaccines contain thimerosal. And thimerosal is a protective agent to be sure that we don't have any contamination occur in a vial of vaccine that is entered multiple times, with sterile needles. But still, there's the potential there and for contamination, and the thimerosal helps prevent that and makes the vaccine more safe. But that's only in the multiple dose vials of vaccine. We have pediatric vaccines that do not have thimerosal. But even if we didn't, as you pointed out, this is one of the issues that has caused great concerns about vaccines in the last few years. I personally feel we've been our own worst enemies on this because in trying to be sure that we were doing everything to allay people's fears, we made something look like it was a much bigger problem than any science had shown that it was. But for people who are concerned about that in influenza vaccine, we do have pediatric influenza vaccine that doesn't have thimerosal in it.
What's thimerosal?
Thimerosal, as I mentioned, it's a bacteriostatic. It's to stop contamination from occurring, but it is basically half a formation of ethyl mercury, and so that's what makes people concerned. Even though study after study after study is now showing that there isn't any problem with it in the vaccines.
Okay, so yeah, I wanted to see if I could get you to use the word mercury in the same sentence.
I wasn't trying to avoid it.
So thimerosal was associated in some people's minds with an increased risk for autism after certain vaccines, despite the fact that it's now almost certain scientifically that that is not an issue, and that that mercury is probably not an issue. And thimerosal was there for a very good reason, but as much as possible, it's been removed from a safety standpoint anyway.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that that was very much a precautionary move, that there was not any scientific data to suggest that vaccines were causing autism or that even that they had necessarily dangerously high levels of mercury. But anything that can be done to reduce exposure to mercury is a good idea. And as Laurel has pointed out, over the past 10 years, the accumulation of data not making that connection or refuting the connection between thimerosal and autism has really become quite large. When we look at, for instance, in California, there was a call early on to ban thimerosal-containing vaccines. That was done as eventually thimerosal was removed from vaccines for children most everywhere, at least the dose was minimized. The rates of autism in California have continued just as they had before. We haven't seen any reversal there. So I think we struggle with that issue of coincident causality, as you were mentioning earlier. Autism generally has its onset during early childhood, which is also the time when we administer a lot of vaccines. Thimerosal has been in vaccines since the 1930s. We've increased the number of vaccines we use, but we've also changed how we define autism. Many things that were not identified as autism or autism spectrum disorder are now received that label. So it's actually debated in the neurologic world about whether or not the true incidence of autism has increased or not. We're certainly much more aware of it. And it's a devastating disease.
Right.
I mean, we in no way want to minimize the impact of that disease on children and families.
But if, again, getting back to this, the business of why logical fallacies are important and coincidence and causality is if something, two things happen closely related, it's logical, and in fact, most of us probably genetically predisposed to think that those two things are related. But the evidence for this association is deteriorating. There's almost none, and it is not truly logical to assume that because two things happen close together that they are cause and effect. And we went through this from a public health standpoint back when I was in training, is there was an association for a brief period of time with DPT and sudden infant death, which later also didn't pan out.
And it certainly becomes very confusing, too, the way sometimes events are reported in the media. In fact, this week's Time magazine includes a summary of the Hannah Poling case, which basically was a legal settlement, which using the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, which is designed to give the families or children the benefit of the doubt to be able to cover any possibility of injury due to a vaccine. That's the basis of that award through the court system. Yet it was reported in Time magazine that health experts had made this link. And, you know, I'm not sure where they're getting that because that's simply not the case.
Yeah. I've tried for a while to get some people involved in the reporting, health reporters, and the logics and how well we do this. But the Hannah Poling case is a case where an individual who was actually a neurologist's daughter developed what appears to be autistic-like symptoms after the vaccine, but unfortunately, more complicated, had a pre-existing disorder that could explain everything. But in this case, the legal setting was that we will award vaccine compensation. There was nothing in that decision that said the vaccine caused autism.
Absolutely. It was a legal decision.
Yeah, that's the point.
And we're not probably an appropriate one, too.
Not just picking hairs here. That is not the same issue. And to this date, there's not. And that even if it is that was the case, that's so far different than tons and tons and tons and tons of other evidence to suggest there is no association with the vaccine. It still would be probably somewhat inconsequential unless you just absolutely have an ideological belief that that's the problem.
Yes.
Okay. Question from a caller. Vitamin D comes up everywhere nowadays. It says, are there studies to point to a link between vitamin D and incidence of she used the word flu, or he. I'm going to say influenza. That's what they're asking. So is vitamin D in any way related to susceptibility, I think, is what the issue is of influenza.
There are – it depends on what you'll accept as evidence. And this gets back to our earlier conversation about associations not necessarily being linked with causation. And I'm not even aware myself of any specific associations between vitamin D levels and risk of influenza. There are some emerging data on vitamin D levels and risk of certain types of cancer and the invasiveness of cancer. It certainly is also clear for those of us living in the far north that we're at greater risk of relatively low serum vitamin D levels compared to those that live in more tropical areas. So I think the most honest answer to the question is I don't know, and I'm also skeptical that there's any strong causation between vitamin D levels and the risk of influenza.
Okay. Other issues about influenza or the vaccine that we need to make sure we get discussed? We got about 5 or 6 or so minutes left. I want to make sure that there's not a burning issue in anybody's mind before I carry on with my questions here.
I don't believe anything else about influenza per se that we haven't already discussed. But before we run out of time, I would like to say for people that are interested in learning more about the thimerosal vaccine, including the proposed connection with autism, I would really recommend a good website that I don't believe that you had up on your website yet, Dr. Woodard, and that's for the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and it's www.chop.edu. And the reason I recommend it is because there are some wonderful question and answer fact sheets there that parents can understand about vaccines and thimerosal and why we do what we do, and reminding people also of the tremendous risk that we had from these diseases that now parents don't even see anymore. And it's hard sometimes when you're looking at a lot of information on the internet to not feel concerned when you think these diseases have gone away when in fact they haven't. And so whether it's influenza or any other vaccine, I would really recommend that as a great site for information.
I think one of the reasons that may be one of the better sites is the pediatric infectious disease specialist at Children's in Philadelphia. I want to say his name is Hofer.
Dr. Paul Offit.
Has written a very good book just recently that kind of chronicles this whole issue as critically, I think, as it could be done. And so I'm sure that's
it's
part of
it. It's an excellent book. The name of it is Autism's False Prophets. And right. He goes to great lengths to explain his passion and his concern as a pediatrician for finding what is really the cause of this, but not to be fooled by so many false accusations that have been made out there.
But the whole idea of immunization in general, Dr. Butler, would it be worthwhile to just kind of talk about where the idea came from and how it's evolved and improved and what may be real risks? I mean, you hear things like, gosh, we shouldn't give our kids this many vaccines because it overwhelms the immune system. And I think there's a naivety about understanding the immune system in the first place, but also what's in these vaccines and the safety and the efforts that are made to make sure they're safe.
Right. Well, immunization basically means developing antibody or protective substances in the bloodstream against foreign microorganisms, or it doesn't just include organisms. It can be any foreign substance. The concern about overwhelming the immune system doesn't really fit with the world we live in. We live in a microbial soup, if you will. In fact, there's more bacteria in our bodies than there are actually human cells. They say there's 6 billion bacteria in the average human mouth. So we're exposed all the time to microorganisms, and our immune systems are continually operating to protect us against those things. The goal of immunization is to be able to harness that ability of the body to be able to protect us then against infections that can actually hurt us. And of course, it goes back a long way to when first smallpox vaccination was performed using cowpox, and then later a virus we know as vaccinia, which is where we get the term vaccination from, which we've come to apply very broadly to all types of immunizations. And but we're exposed naturally to all kinds of things every day. So even though it's painful to perhaps watch our child receive sometimes three or four injections at once, the idea that it's going to overwhelm the immune system is a little bit of a stretch.
No, come on. That's a big stretch. I mean, it's kind of like trying to think you're going to get the salt out of the ocean. I mean, if there's billions of bacteria and every one of those are stimulating our immune system every minute of the day, then a handful of vaccine constituents are really a drop in the bucket statistically. And I don't want to overdo it either. And I know there's, you know, you want to be very good as a scientist, but it really is not overwhelming the immune system.
It doesn't make sense.
That's not going to happen. Okay. How about other things that are in these vaccines? What are the precautions? What are the worries? What are real notified, we know, problems that have happened with vaccines that we may need to be aware of?
Well, when I'm talking to people about vaccines, I always try to point out that no one should ever say that all vaccines are 100% safe for 100% of people. But on the other hand, you have to look at the risk and the benefits associated with it. It's like saying that perhaps not everyone can take an aspirin, but for most people, an aspirin is a good and effective medication to use. But there are some people who shouldn't get certain immunizations. And so physicians and other healthcare providers will ask some basic series of questions before giving immunizations to make sure that they're screening the person appropriately. Sometimes it can be some of the ingredients that are in the vaccines themselves, but and so you're asking questions like that. Sometimes it can be related to the condition of the person, whether they have a normally functioning immune system, for example, or we try to screen out for certain vaccines whether or not a woman might be pregnant, for example. So you just need to ask some basic questions. It's a little hard to say, you know, just a general statement, but that's why it's important to talk with your healthcare provider about any concerns that you might have.
We got 1 minute. What's the message you want to leave the listeners with?
Diseases that can be prevented by vaccines are still around. They can still, they're a plane ride away, or they're already here. And if we drop down on our immunization coverage, we will be seeing diseases again in Alaska that we thought were long gone.
And I'll add to that one on specifically to influenza is that the biggest misnomer in medicine is just the flu. Influenza can be a very serious infection, and it's one that's why we're here talking about how to prevent it.
And from a public health standpoint, those of us even at not high risk, it's worthwhile getting the vaccine to help prevent others from perhaps catching it from us.
You can protect those and the people you love.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in working adults, actually, that's the group that probably economically benefits the most, because there's good documented studies that people who have received the vaccine are less likely to miss work because of influenza-like illness.
Thanks again to Dr. Jay Butler and Laurel Wood. It's been stimulating and hopefully educational. I appreciate it. Next week, we'll be discussing the U.S. healthcare system again. We've done this a couple of times. I'm going to be doing it with Paul Hochfield. He's an ER physician in Oregon, who's gone so far as to produce a documentary film on this. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, December 8th at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat the same evening at 7 p.m. For KSKA and Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.